Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme, we consult the map.
Maps are just this portal to an infinite number of questions that you can ask about not only the place that is being represented, but the map makers themselves.
The design of a transit map doesn't just help its city dwellers get from A to B, it also contributes much to the visual and cultural identity of the city that it serves. But how does the way a subway schematic looks actually have an impact on urban mobility? And has tradition stood in the way of progress when it comes to famous layouts like the New York subway and London tube maps? Or do they really get it right at the first go? Join us over the next 30 minutes as our guests explore the wonderful world of urban cartography right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Max Roberts, lecturer in psychology at the University of Essex and researcher into map usability and aesthetics, and Ed Jefferson, freelance writer and tube map enthusiast. And I'm also joined down the line from California by Laura Bliss, CityLab's West Coast bureau chief and writer of Map Lab, a bi-weekly newsletter about maps. Welcome to you all. Max, maybe I can start with you. You're a bit of a tube map obsessive. It's a very famous map, of course, that many Londoners think is a thing of beauty. But you're not so sure about it. Can you explain why you see some problems with the London tube map?
The main problem is that although the network's expanded massively since the 1930s, the map is exactly the same size as it was when Henry Beck first did his sketch. So it's having to absorb more and more stations at the same size. And the other thing is that the map pretty well dates from the year 2000, and it wasn't designed with all these overground extensions in mind. And they've just added them in rather than thinking about, is this the right way to do things? So there's some quite horrible geographical nasties on it now, stations which are well out of place, which now that they're showing walking interchanges on the map is actually quite disorientating. So it's crushed up, it's all twisted up, and it's geographically wrong as well, which is about as bad as you can get for a map.
They do try and tweak it and change it. And every time they do that, there seems to be even another round of controversy. People don't like that thing being tinkered with. Mm-hmm. Something from the 1930s that Mr. Beck made, they still want to keep hold of it. Why is it so difficult to change it?
Because if they want to change it properly, they'd have to make it on a bigger sheet of paper. And that gives you all sorts of logistical problems. It's more expensive to print, to distribute, and to put on racks. And they're trying to save money with this anyway. If you sort of feel the thickness of the paper compared with 10 years ago, it's pretty floppy these days.
Ed, we're talking here about, and we're going to be looking at some very physical maps, maps on paper, maps that here in London we're used to seeing posted up in stations. But a lot of the work that you've done is looking at maps in a kind of social media age and an age of technology. Are we wrong to be thinking about their representation always as pieces of paper, as physical maps like that? You know, even this kind of data for a tube map is a revolution that needs to happen so that we can see it on our phones in better ways, that it's more designed for today's technology.
Well, there's two ways of looking at this, right? Because in many ways, kind of, we're being encouraged away from using maps at all. Like, most people in London will probably have City Mapper on their phone and they can just put in where exactly they're going and it'll just tell you, get on this line and get on this line and then get on this bus or whatever it is. And you won't ever have had to look at the map or undo that understanding yourself. And in some ways that is easier. It's easier not to have to kind of follow all those things through. But then to actually have an understanding of kind of how it works, especially if it, because that's all very well and good until the tube breaks down and you're at a tube station you've never heard of and you get out and you have to try and figure out, okay, where actually am I in relation to anything? And so there is a sense in which it still is important to have like a map that is easily understandable and you can understand how everything interrelates. And whether it's on paper or you're scrolling around it on your screen, I think ultimately it is always going to be useful to have that map. And I think even most of the apps do have like a backup mode where if you're offline, they'll have a downloaded map that if all else fails, you'll be able to go and look at that.
And Laura, you're joining us from the United States. Does the London tube map crop up for you as a topic of interest?
Yeah, so I'm a West Coast bureau chief at CityLab, where we write about urban policy and politics. And we just closed out a 3-month-long essay series on the power of maps in personal lives to sort of shape personal histories. And we had a lot of submissions about our readers and writers' attachments to the transit maps in their cities and kind of how the subway maps or bus route maps helped open up a new kind of understanding of the place that they lived. And I think that as one of the few remaining kind of common touch points that we have in, you know, 21st century urban life, even if, you know, we're no longer using paper maps to necessarily navigate as much anymore, I do think that like these common paper maps do become a shared understanding of the places we live. And I think it can really kind of knock people over when changes are suggested or made. And one really just interesting fact about the London Tube map is a story that came out of some research from a couple of years ago. And that was a pair of economists looked at what happened when a branch between two London Tube stations was shut down as a result of a strike in 2017. And they studied the paths that the passengers made when they were not navigating the tube underground and solely on the basis of the maps. And they actually found that passengers discovered that there was a much shorter route in navigating between Paddington Station and Bond Street Station when they were actually traveling on the street versus traveling from Paddington Station to Bond Street Station underground. And that was solely because of how distorted the map was in that particular spot. And so it's just a really interesting story that highlights the stark differences between reality and the kind of shared truth that I think these transit maps create.
Ed, when we're trying to encourage people to walk more in our urban environments, that is a problem with the London map, isn't it? Because often people look at that tube map and they think, I need to get on the tube to go between Leicester Square and Piccadilly Circus. It looks a long way, and they don't realise it's literally 100 metres apart. That the distorted map isn't very good at that. And we have a new wayfinding system in the last few years in London that tries to encourage people to see what the walking distances are. Is that another argument for potentially changing the London subway map, that it just really doesn't match up with the passenger needs in a way?
I mean, it is a thing. I always remember having an argument with people about 15 years ago when I was first living in London, that some people who weren't living in London came to see me and we were in town and they were going, what are you talking about? We need to get the tube from Leicester Square to Covent Garden. Like, it took me probably about as long to argue my case that we didn't need to do that as we could have was walking it. But the lack of geographical information can be a problem. And I've lived in places that aren't really represented on the tube map. So I lived somewhere where it was sort of very vaguely, you could have called it Finsbury Park, but it wasn't really near Finsbury Park. Like, that wasn't the nearest station, but the nearest station was a train station that wasn't on the tube map. So there are these places that sort of exist in London, but sort of fall out of existence because they're not represented on the one map of London that everyone's aware of. And I live somewhere now that sort of, I live near Manor Park, which is on the Crossrail line. So it's a place that is coming into existence finally after years of being on some little rail line that no one cared about. It's finally going to be one day, if Crossrail ever opens, on the tube map. And it's interesting that that does obviously have, as well as the consequences of it, at like the transport infrastructure being better, it probably does help that it exists on the map for things like property prices and kind of just awareness of it as a place you might want to go, because these places are invisible if they're not represented, which is a kind of interesting thing about the fact that it's a map that's not a map, because it doesn't actually necessarily have to represent anything other than the tube stations.
Max, you've unfurled several maps here of London. Before we move away from London, I know you've attempted to redesign this. You've tried to make your own journeys around London in a more kind of harmonious route. And, well, certainly in central London, you've tried to show a more circular, softer route away around the city. You've tried to do a complete concentric version of getting around the city. And I think as many people have thought maybe you were onto something, as many people kind of got really cross about it as well.
Yes.
But this map, tell us about this map.
It's another way of doing things. This is a Dutch research team who said that geography matters in the centre to tourists, so they'll make the centre of London geographical. And in the suburbs, fewer tourists go there, so we'll make the suburbs diagrammatic, give people the best of both worlds so they can see how and where to walk in the middle. So there's tourist attractions here as well. This is by Paul Mixenaar at Delft University. That was sent to the underground in the 1980s, and it was a nice idea. There's lots of different ways of doing it. Just because Henry Beck did it in a certain way in 1933, it doesn't mean that that's the perfect way to map.
No, but it's strange that even though it's not illegal to make another tube map, nobody else seems to have come up with something that actually the public will adopt, and in the end, that's what's needed to kind of any kind of breakthrough.
The public will take what TfL gives them, but TfL's not very interested in researching into alternative ways of doing the map, which might be fit for purpose, better for the 21st century.
Laura, I want to bring you in here. And before we dive back into the world of transit maps, I looked through some of the things that you've reported on. It's like climate change maps, how Google Maps encourages people to walk or not walk, even where the Midwest really is in America. Mapping, you know, we feel of as an old pursuit when we think of like the maps our parents used to unfurl in the car when they were getting lost. But for you, maps are something very immediate, political, social. Just tell us why maps have fascinated you.
I think that's just it. I think that maps are a fascinating lens for understanding political choices that the map makers made, you know, that might be based on their own presumptions or understanding of a place, or, you know, based on a certain set of desires for understanding among the readers of those maps. And we regard maps, I think, as something that is quite factual, when in fact there are all kinds of subjectivities and potential biases that might go into them. And of course, there's a range here, right? I mean, you can have straightforward propaganda coming out from a government that might want its people to believe something. And then you have things like Google Maps, you know, that are relied upon by millions of people around the world for just a very sort of basic workaday tool for navigating a city, but still have their own kind of decisions built in. I mean, one of the most interesting examples of this, I think, and this gets back to a point that was being made just a moment ago with the London Tube map and kind of the politics of like which station is displayed most prominently, and is it to the south or to the west, and what kind of impact does that just minor adjustment and position have on the reader and the decisions they might make. Google Maps a couple of years ago came out with something called Areas of Interest. And this is one of the many kind of subtle changes that roll out, you know, on a monthly basis to Google Maps, which I'm sure regular users have noticed here and there, but probably not every single one. But Areas of Interest was where Google basically overlaid a kind of orangey shade onto what it regarded as some of the most busy foot traffic shopping corridors in a given city. And the idea was that, you know, doing this will kind of highlight for tourists or even locals, you know, where the kind of most interesting areas are. But of course, this has its own kind of assumptions built in, and their methodology for deciding, you know, where these corridors should be was based on their own cell phone data, largely. So it's sort of this self-reinforcing cycle of the people who are using maps and sending pings to Google and, you know, making credit card transactions in certain areas are popping up on the map as the most interesting areas. But then it raises the question, right? But what about the other neighborhoods that there might be more cash transactions happening or where there's less internet access? Does that mean that those areas are inherently less interesting for some reason? So I think maps are just this portal to an infinite number of questions that you can ask about not only the place that is being represented, but the map makers themselves.
Well, before we get into some of the worst examples of transit maps, let's hear from what America's editor at large thinks of another of the world's most famous designs, the New York subway map. Here's Ed Stocker.
Pelham 123, come in, please.
This is Pelham. Identify yourself, please.
Oh, this is Lieutenant Zachary Garber of the Transit Police. Identify yourself, please.
I'm the man who stole your train.
The New York subway, immortalized in classic films such as The Taking of Pelham 123 and made legendary by Brooklyn rapper Jay-Z, whose stage name references two subway lines near where he grew up.
Yeah, I'm out at Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow, but I'll be hood forever.
Navigating its design history, though, can be confusing. About as confusing, in fact, as trying to work out what the garbled voice is saying over the train's often dysfunctional public address system. And yet, for all the criticism levelled at the NYC Underground Network, more on that later, one thing is clear. Its graphic design is, well, clear. It certainly wasn't always the case. In fact, it took decades for a coherent system to emerge, from the route map to wayfinding signage. It needed the combination of three different networks and the emergence of the Metropolitan Transit Authority, better known as the MTA, for it all to fall into place. Prior to an overhaul in the 1960s, things were a mess. There was a plethora of competing and varied signage, some of which remains, from hanging signs cluttering stations to various different types of mosaic or tile for station names, some influenced by Beaux-Arts and Deco. The MTA introduced a universal font at the end of the 1960s called Standard, alongside a new signage system. It was overseen by the famed Unimark international design firm, headed in NYC by Italian Massimo Vignelli, who also oversaw a big map redesign. At the time, before the advent of digital made life a whole lot easier, font plates had to be physically imported, and the business was controlled by just a few companies, meaning the popular but expensive Swiss Helvetica font, touted for its clarity and not dissimilar to the sans serif standard, would have to wait a while before it started conquering New York's subway. But conquer it did, partly because the way the J came out in standard was problematic. By the end of the 1980s, it had been adopted into official usage. And while Vignelli's wayfinding largely lives on, the map he came up with in 1972 doesn't, even if it continues to make design aficionados around the globe swoon. Prints of the map, in fact, signed by Vignelli, who died in 2014, are currently on sale on the New York Transit Museum's website for $1,200 a pop. A radical departure from the old, with brightly coloured lines clearly influenced by Henry Beck's 1933 London Underground map, and drawn for clarity rather than geographical accuracy, New Yorkers complained about the new map's beige-coloured water and the oddly shaped Central Park. In 1979, the MTA bowed to pressure and replaced it with a more accurate version, to the lament of many. Today, the subway irks passengers for reasons other than wayfinding. From the sheer dirtiness of stations to a chronic lack of investment, that means delays are constant. Yet while you're not always assured of getting to your destination on time, the legacy of the past really does live on, and negotiating your way around subway platforms is a breeze. Just don't ask us if that Express A train has actually switched to running local or not. For Monocle, I'm Ed Stocker.
Thanks, Ed. So now we're going to look at some of the worst designs, and we have in front of us here three maps: the Central London night bus routes, the public transport network of Debrecen in Hungary, and Josephine County transit map of Oregon. Ed, perhaps first of all to you, when you see these bad examples like the London night bus map, what are some of the rules that you think maps should be following, and where do you think these ones have gone astray?
I think that the issue you always have with bus maps, and I think TfL have gone back and forth over the kinds of bus maps they have, is that you do have to represent so much data, and that whether or not you can actually do it, like, the solution to this probably isn't a map. It probably is whether you're putting it into Google Maps or City Map or an app, or just finding out where the nearest bus is and how to get home. There's probably 100 bus routes represented on this piece of A4 paper, that, and it can't show you, if it was trying to show you all the actual routes rather than the stops they applied to, it wouldn't be very helpful. But once you actually look, I don't think enough it's that unhelpful. It's unhelpful to look at as a whole. You can sort of find out which stops a bus goes through, but you kind of need to kind of have someone explain to you, like, some sort of methodology for how to use this before it could become useful.
Max, you've talked in the past about informational pollution. I think this is a fine example, isn't it? But again, also the one of Hungary. Well, so a couple of points. Is this the problem, information or pollution? And the other thing is, you know, have we just moved on to a point when you have things like Citymapper that we shouldn't even be thinking about this world of maps anymore because they are just less helpful than something on your phone?
The problem with the London map is that it's diagrammatic and buses don't turn into diagrams very well because the evidence from your eyes disagrees with the document in your hands. And it's quite useful, so knowing the shapes of the streets, to know where you are. It's also not got enough information on here. It's not named all the bus stops. You know, there's a bus stop called Wormwood Street near Liverpool Street. It'd be useful to know actually where that is in relation to where you are. And yes, the London map's not got too much information on it. It's just not been designed with a thought about, you know, the actual bus user. Hungary is a sort of multicoloured tangle of all sorts of routes, and that's over-colour coded. I've seen bus maps which do it better, which try and group the bus routes into sort of some sort of logical grouping, fewer colours, give you a better idea of the streets which the buses actually go along, because the underground is sort of creates its own reality of dark tunnels and disorientation. But on the city streets, you know, the bus map has to sort of fit in with the reality which is all around you.
Laura, I'm going to jump across to you. We sent you the transport maps as well, the city transport maps. You can tell us about those, but just tell us, you're, I believe, in San Francisco, you know the US well. Is there good and bad examples that you see that encourage you or discourage you to use urban transport where you are?
Yes. I mean, I think it's very common to find almost illegible like bus route maps like this in many, many American cities. And one of the things that I find most interesting about this Josephine County transit bus map that I think you all have in front of you too is, like, to me, it reflects another very common trend in, you know, US urban transportation circles, which is like the people who are in charge of setting routes and indeed, you know, drawing and writing the important documents that are relied upon for navigating that system do not necessarily use the systems themselves. And, you know, this Josephine County, it's such an extreme example. It's like, well, why did they start with this area of the map that's like three times larger than the actual area of the bus service? They've clustered all the transfer points together in a way that's just totally illegible. You know, you can see these bus lines in bright color, but it's too far away to see like what streets they actually correspond to. And so it's not that hard to imagine that the person who was making this map was like literally doing it from a 1,000-foot remove from the actual experience of riding the system. So I guess it sort of goes in both directions too. Like, I think we can have more useful maps if the people who are in charge of making them are in touch with like the actual experience of whatever they're representing. The New York Times just a couple of weeks ago did a really phenomenal interactive story about the creation of the New York City subway map and kind of going back in time and looking at the famous Massimo Vignelli 1972 map and how it compares to today. And it mentioned that the designer of the map that's currently in use, whose name I'm forgetting, actually wrote every single line from start to finish. Supposedly, this may be sort of a legend, but supposedly with his eyes closed and tried to sort of sketch out the line of movement as he felt it on the subway and tried to translate that onto the map that he drew.
The Oregon map actually does give some very helpful information, which none of the other maps do, because you can actually see which part of the city is served by your bus. You can see if you live in a certain place, you can see, well, if I want to go to another place, I need the red route, then the blue route. And that it actually gives you a sense of how the network is put together, which you don't get from either the other two maps.
Is it fair to just say that buses are a bit harder to map than subways? There tends to be more of them,
a more
complex number of stops. And
yeah, it needs more work, more thought, more care.
Laura, we'll quickly just go around everyone as a finishing point. You know, that, yeah, here in London, it's quite often you see somebody with, there's sneakers now, which have like bits of the tube on, tube lines. There's the tube signs here are very popular as posters, as T-shirts, all sorts of things. They're part of the identity of London. Do these done well, does the wayfinding, the mapping become part of a city's identity?
Yes, I think that's definitely true. The logos also of your local metro system, right? I've seen that become kind of popularized, just like sports teams, you know, I mean, maybe for a somewhat like nerdier subset of a city population. But I think similar to like the local team, right? I think people are eager to pick up on these visual cues as identity markers and of something to be proud of. It helps when the transportation system that you're repping is actually like good and useful.
And Ed, for you as well, is in the end, for all the criticism of it, is the London Underground tube map and the identity built around it an important part of our city identity?
I think it's an unavoidably important part. I think the thing to avoid, if possible, is making it the only way of thinking about the city. I think it is a very kind of specific way of looking at the city. And it, as we've already talked about, the unintended consequences of people thinking you can't walk between places that are very close together. But there are places that if you only think about a city in terms of the transport map, you would never think to visit. And some of them might be the more interesting places. Some of them might be the very boring places. That's why they haven't built a tube station. But I think it's important not to confuse it with a map of London. It's just a map of one slice of the city.
Max, finally, do you think there's hope for your new version of the tube map? Or do you think that in 100 years' time, we'll still be stuck with something that is related to the work of Mr. Beck?
100 years' time, I'm not sure there even be an underground network.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to Laura Bliss, Ed Jefferson and Dr. Max Roberts for joining me here on The Urbanist. That's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. To play you out of this week's episode, here's Yeah Yeah Yeahs with Maps. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. Wait.